that is also an opportunity waiting to be exploited in the positive sense of the word. When we got to Zambia, what we learned is that they have studied Oregon's forestry industry. They see us as a model for sustainable development. They would like to engage in a partnership that would involve technology transfer. We have a lot of unused equipment. We have a lot of folks in our timber industry who are out of work. It's a relationship that's just waiting to be developed. 4 years later, we're still waiting for a connection to be made with our Oregon Economic and Community Development Department and the International Division. We all know, and Mr. Chair, you know this from your recent experience in Taiwan, that another key tenet of trade is relationships. We go where we have relationships. And what I want to say to our committee, just by way of a reminder, is that we have an opportunity waiting for us in Zambia that we've yet to explore and exploit. And we have other opportunities in other African nations. South Africa is another one. Now, our governor has made a commitment to lead a trade mission to African nations, several African nations, before he's out of office, and I'm certainly going to be one to try to hold him to that. I would ask folks on this panel to get your passport and to broaden the way that we look at where we want to do international business. Asia is a partner, most certainly. We do some business with Africa, but there are also other places in Africa that we should be looking, and we're just not doing it. We're not being aggressive enough.
Senator Gordley, I would echo those comments. You make a very strong point. In my travels in Africa, and actually some recent work in the last 3 months, Africa is a place that no other states are actively trading with. It is an absolute, probably one of the biggest opportunities, if the logistics can be set up, for many of our products, and the services sector that we can provide in clean, green, and forestry. As far as Taiwan goes, it's very fitting that you would mention that and you gentlemen would be sitting here. Taiwan is in a recession right now. However, their government let the first contract out with a foreign entity, and you know who it was with? Oregon. No other states, no other countries. It was with our state, with country. In fact, there's a group called Team Oregon who operates right now in Taipei. Unfortunate, though, is we don't have direct flights anymore to Taipei. We have lost shipping opportunities to Taipei. While they want our agricultural products, our forest products, and value-added products, we have made it more difficult on ourselves from an Oregon business standpoint to do business with them, even though they're with open arms ready to do business with us. So that's a exceptional point.
That's true.
Senator Mesley, and then Senator Messinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're hitting on an area that I'm very concerned about. Mr. Levitt, you mentioned that you didn't want to get into the deepening project, but I'm very concerned, and it gets back to what we've talked about repeatedly here this morning, about the process and the permits and how you get these things done. And it goes beyond just what it costs the Port of Portland or the Port of Coos Bay or any of our coastal areas that are trying to develop business and move forward. It really very directly affects the private sector as well, on the same percentage or maybe even on a higher percentage. But I would be very interested if in your work on deepening the Columbia, and I guess I should say first that we all recognize how important deepening that Columbia is and maintaining that channel. So it's not a question whether we have a ship channel or not. It's just a question of the cost of getting the project done. But I'd be very interested to know what the cost or the percentage of the cost of the project is to get through all the environmental statements and the hearings and everything, and added to that the cost of the mitigation to get the project done. For my communities on the coast, it's a real showstopper. Whether you're trying to put in a sawmill or a service station or whatever, when they add on the mitigation costs, as an example, it's sometimes 3 to 4 times a factor of 3 to 4 times to mitigate. Many of our business simply drop the idea and head for the valley. They can put in a business, they can invest much more reasonably in the Willamette Valley or in other areas than they can in the coastal regions. And, you know, we can spend all the money in the world trying to get economies going in some of these rural areas, but if we've got showstoppers like that, burdens that we have to overcome, it's simply we're not in a competitive position and we absolutely can't compete. So it would give me an idea of if you could articulate just how expensive, and I know you're not there yet even, but this is getting to be for you to move forward on that project.
Mr. Chair and Senator Messerly, I can't give you a specific number, but I can give you some sort of a feeling of what essentially the process and the cost of that process. We've been involved in the essentially the study phase of channel deepening since 1993, and the project actually officially began in 1989. And that study up to today is the official cost of the study was $6.1 million, and I'm sure we're up in the $10 million range today. And that's purely just the study of the engineering and the environmental issues connected to the project. The project is estimated, once it's constructed, to cost about in the range of $186 million. I hesitate to land on any specific number as far as the cost of the environmental components. And in this project, I'll tell you, it's not just mitigation, which is, we have no qualm with and no concern about. That's essentially mitigating for the impact of constructing the project. And I'm gonna guess that mitigation is in the $20-30 million, you know, just the direct mitigation. But there's also another $10 million that's already in the project for restoration. So you construct the project, you mitigate back to the level that you started, and then you do some restoration beyond that so that when you leave the river, it's in better shape with the project than without. And that's been the goal all along. And we're not done yet. The review phase for channel deepening kicks into high gear literally in the next few weeks, and you're probably going to see some more articles on that as we move into the endangered species and the biological opinion coming up in March, Clean Water Act certifications throughout next year. And I'm hoping a year from now that we will have met those requirements and are able to move forward with the project, but the costs are growing.
Just a quick follow-up, if my math is right, and particularly if you factor in the cost of the delays, the time factor that we've heard about today, easily 25% of the cost of the project is in getting through the process. And I'm not saying that's all bad. I just think that when we're talking 10-plus years to get to a project, and then many of our small businesses, I've heard as much as 6 years, it's just plain ridiculous. And people are going to pull away and go someplace else.
And just a quick point on that, Mr. Chair and Senator Messerly, that actually is the more important issue. It's the amount of time that it takes, and it's the level of uncertainty that are, frankly, the process has in it, that it doesn't allow us to go and talk to a carrier, talk to Hanjin, and say, don't go, don't leave. This project's going to get done. They've been waiting for 12 years now for the project to get done, and they're not able to be certain in there as they plan their business that they can deploy their larger vessels. It's simple. They've got larger vessels. They want to be able to utilize those vessels. They can't do it to the level that they would like to in the Columbia River, so they go to other ports. And it's that uncertainty that's been probably the biggest problem on the marketing side of what we do.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Co-Chair Atkinson. First of all, I think
Well, thank actually Ambassador Atkinson, who just firmed up all those issues in Taiwan. And for committee members, I know that he's still suffering from a little jet lag. I do want to mention, though, I think to the members, I think Senator Gordley's points were excellent, as were Senator Atkinson's, on point to what you said, Keith, in terms of having a strategic plan for trade. And I think I would just remind the members that many sessions ago in the legislature, 171.80, we established the Joint Legislative Committee on Trade and Development, and during the last number of sessions, that committee has not been funded or enacted, and yet it's in our statute. There's reporting requirements of groups to a statutory committee on that point that does not exist. So I think one of the things that we might consider, certainly in the next session, is to see the value of that strategic need for international trade, and have what our predecessors put into the statute and enact that Legislative Committee on Trade and Development, and bring that focus, I think, to this important issue. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, there's so many things being said. I'm just going to focus on just a few things in this whole thing. I'm interested in infrastructure, energy, and what we do with our present employees. You said infrastructure, Mr. Armstrong. You meant what? Just quickly, what did you mean by that?
Buildings, Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, buildings, sewer, water, roads.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, we've got one more person to testify before lunch.
Just one more question, if I may, for Mr. Leavitt. Are you familiar with what the governor is going to say to the court today? Does that have any bearing on this hearing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, he's speaking to the Port Commission tomorrow, and I know he is going to touch on international trade. I don't know that any of his comments will specifically add to this discussion.
Thank you.
Senator George. Really quickly, when Delta pulled out, did they approach the port with any attempt to mitigate their costs or anything, come to you saying, listen, could you help us out on this effort? Because, you know, you sit there and we went from 30 Asian businesses to 150 and 690 companies who are dependent upon connection with Asia. With the loss of that, I mean, should we have been looking at some sort of subsidy to keep them in place? What's your opinion on something like that?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, that becomes a real slippery slope that you go down you should look at and think about, but we did. We had very high-level discussions literally with the governor and the head of Delta. We have since then organized this business community that has this direct relationship to Asia, and even talked about buying seats on planes and committing those seats off into the future. One of the problems is some communities are willing to literally just buy these services, and the gap that we had to close with Delta with what they were looking at in their financial picture was it was like a $30 million gap, something that was not even approachable. And part of it was just driven by that company's where they were heading as a company and what their financial challenges were and why they wanted to consolidate some of their air service into other areas.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sheila Holden from the Northeast Economic Development Alliance. Thank you for waiting, and thank you for coming.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Barely.
Please state your name for the record.
Okay. My name is Sheila Holden, S-H-E-I-L-A-H-O-L-D-E-N. Good morning again, Senators. I live in Northeast Portland, and I am a Pacific Power executive on special assignment working with the Northeast Economic Development Alliance, which I chair, and also with the Interstate Urban Renewal Advisory Committee, which I co-chair. Historically, we have worked with our state legislators to develop local tools to spur economic growth and job creation in the state's most consistently vulnerable area, which is Northeast Portland. The Alliance is an 18-member partnership of businesses, neighborhoods, nonprofits, government agencies, and community-based organizations. We work to strategically leverage resources and expertise in that area to develop people, to develop our community, to create wealth among individuals and businesses, and to create jobs and economic sustainability for Northeast Portland. We have been working over the years with Representative Carter and more recently with Senator Gordley and Senator Farioli to recognize that our needs are not just those needs of Northeast Portland, but there are economically distressed areas around the state that share some of our same concerns. And we look for ways to partner with those communities as well. But what we're finding in Northeast Portland is in this economic recession, we're right now at a very critical time. We are at a period where we are starting to see some real benefit in some of the tools that have been put in place. The area is redeveloping, but there's a strange phenomena that has come with that redevelopment that is putting added pressure on that community and the community's most vulnerable members. And that is that as we redevelop, we are finding that those who are not quite on the economic upturn are finding themselves being squeezed out of their neighborhoods and squeezed out of their business. So this recession is causing the skilled to lose their jobs and creating less access to jobs to those folks who are less skilled, and therefore creating displacement and gentrification in our community as it redevelops. The answer, we feel, is training, a training system that is more finely tuned and driven by the employer's skills required and the labor force's needs for job readiness, to be prepared for those jobs. The answer is the growth of our micro businesses, the attraction of new support industry for the stable industries that exist in our area, and strategic new markets being brought into the community. A number of the things that I've heard speakers talk about earlier this morning. The answer is maintaining the support for the engine that drives our quality of life, the economy, and our ability to produce the jobs that supports it. Our state cannot afford in these times the increasing demand for social and judicial services that a growing chronically unemployed base creates. I heard one of the senators mention, what about human resources and what about insurance and the needs for benefits and what have you that we would see with a downturn in the economy. Those are things that we feel will be exacerbated, especially in the economically lagging areas, if we don't do what we can to keep in place those economic and community development tools that have been developed for minority businesses to support those areas over the past few years. Now is not the time to cut the programs that create our tax base and reduces the need for human services among our most vulnerable. Find ways to make them more effective, yes, but not to cut them. We would all say, and we do, not envy at all the position that you guys will find yourselves in at the beginning of the next session. If you're able to bite the bullet, you may lose some teeth, as was quoted in the paper. But let's not lose those that will forever alter the face of our state's economy to the point that the progress made in the past 5 years in those economically stressed areas is set back again, and especially not in a community where it probably will not be able to recover, which is Northeast Portland. You will be hearing from my remarks are more general remarks at this point on behalf of the Alliance and the efforts that we're making in Northeast Portland. You will be hearing from others of our organization speaking more directly to minority businesses and the needs for minority businesses, and speaking more directly to jobs and job creation as your process continues this week.
Sheila, thank you very much. Questions? comments?
Follow-up?
Senator Gordon.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Sheila, for making the trip to Salem this morning. I want to ask, the theme of our conversation this morning is ways to attract and grow business in Oregon. And I want to ask you to just draw on your experiences being involved in the Northeast community over the past, 17 years or so, and just focus there, ways to attract and grow. What are you seeing? What's working? What guidance
we have some tools that have been put in place. We have the Enterprise Zone program, which we've been able to put some tools and some teeth into and been able to actually use it to create opportunities to tie existing businesses that are coming into the area or businesses that are threatening to leave the area with the residents in the area to provide jobs. We're able to tie those jobs to training, in-time training, so that local residents would be able to apply and get those jobs. We also have worked with those businesses to do business with the local businesses that already exist in the area. So we form mentorships with those businesses that are fledgling businesses or small businesses in the area to actually do contracts with the larger E-Zone companies. We also have put in place some projects that are more directed toward identifying what are the barriers to small businesses. I mentioned earlier that I agreed with some of the things that have been mentioned by the speakers who came before me. One of the things that we have found is that there's a real need to look at what regulations are impacting small businesses. Quite often what happens, in particular, in one instance, we have a number of businesses in the Vancouver-Williams corridor in Portland. That corridor is one of our largest numbers of minority-owned businesses. It is what was the backbone of the albina community, if you will, in northeast Portland, where black businesses thrived before urban renewal came in about 20 years ago. And those businesses now are, a number of them are trying to actually grow and expand. But because of seismic codes that have been put in place, those businesses are finding their cost to expand increasing, and they don't have the expertise to actually work the system when it comes to land use and planning to be able to get through the process for their permits to actually do the expansion. So what we've been able to do is to work with local government to come up with an advocate who will be able to work with those businesses to work them through that process to help them to actually address the land use and permitting issues, as well as try to deal with some of the regulatory issues. It would be nice, though, to have a more streamlined process so that those businesses are not so adversely impacted. But those are some of the things that we've been doing locally, and some of the things that local businesses are still facing that become exacerbated in a time of recession.
Senator Georgia.
Sheila, thank you for being here, and it's been a pleasure to see some of the redevelopment that's occurring in northeast Portland. But one of the things that we continue to hear is, and I'm going to ask you this question based upon the comments that you made, that some of the redevelopment has actually supplanted then what had been the traditional minority of industry. One of the issues that I keep continue to hear is the idea of reduced access. In other words, we've reduced the number of openings into a business because of new street requirements and this sort of thing, which then makes it impossible for the business to survive because it takes the exchange of customers. And then number two, I'll ask you this one. Is the reason that they are unable to survive, is it the pass-through of the cost of the redevelopment? Is it the property tax rise because of the redevelopment? Why is it that the small businesses after redevelopment, minority businesses, cannot survive?
Part of the problem with small businesses in general is that they have a lifespan, as you know. 6 years out, if you've survived to be 6 years old, you've done a great job. And if you make it to 10, you're a very successful business. What we have with minority-owned businesses is they tend to have less capital to invest into the business. They're running on a tighter, their bottom line is really thin in terms of being able to see profit. And so they are not as able to withstand the time it takes for redevelopment to occur. And as their revenues decrease during that period where redevelopment is occurring, by the time it's done and you see the upturn again, they are in a position where they're about ready to go out the door instead of being able to take advantage of the change. And so that's one of the things that we have to work to address. And we're, in fact, what we're doing with the Interstate Urban Renewal Project now, because we've seen in the past so much of this happening where when it comes time to take advantage of the opportunities, the businesses or the residents are no longer to benefit from it. We are trying to put in place programs that will address that in the interim so that those businesses can continue to thrive and stay in business until they can take advantage of the new market and revenue opportunities that are coming on with the redevelopment.
Senator Messerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sheila, I appreciate your testimony this morning for one reason, because I can see a lot of parallels between what we have in rural Oregon and what you're dealing with in the cities. I don't have a question, but I do have a statement, if you'll allow me, Mr. Chair. And that is that, and I think it does apply to the inner cities as well, but my experience has been with natural resource industries, and what I've seen repeatedly in the last 10 years or more is contrary to what we're used to. And let me just explain it this way, that when you're in the natural resource industry, you're used to downturns because of weather. You're used to downturns because of disease in your product or your commodity. You're used to market cycles. And those are all things that when you're in business, you accept. That's just part of being in business. But what is very difficult to accept is when you are put out of business or you lose your economy because of government policy. And that can be federal, state, and local. But when you see the economy crumbling and being destroyed, just plain and simply because of policy, and then we spend hours trying to figure out how to rebuild it again. And I've seen families, businesses, personalities, individuals die of strokes. I mean, the stress that we put on our populations and on our social communities, it just makes you want to cry ourselves. It makes me want to cry sometimes when I'm in a hearing. I've seen very powerful, successful men, when they get up to testify, absolutely start shaking and just totally lose it. Just stand there and sob because they feel so helpless. And quite frankly, I feel helpless many times as a legislative individual trying to feel like I have a responsibility to my communities, and there's really nothing I can do, at least that I've been able to identify and really make any real change. But so I share your frustrations, and I've talked with Senator Gordley many times that I'd like to work with her as in finding some of these solutions. But it really gets down in many, many cases to making sure that we develop good policy based on sound data and sound science. And I think we've done a pretty bad job of that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
You mentioned something that's been a real bone of contention with me, because I happened to weather the March 25th, 1993 earthquake here, and was kept from coming in the building, and then found out that we were setting in, when we finally got in the building, setting in the chamber of the house where there were several hundred-pound blocks of concrete waiting to go with the boom on us, when there was potential, I guess, shift to the right with the Golden Pioneer up here and so forth. How important, when it gets right down to maintaining and being able to maintain a business, is this business of seismic upgrade?
Let me.
If you have to make a trade-off, where do we make that trade-off? Because I'm here, as far as I know, all of the earthquakes we've had in Oregon, if we put all that damage together, the money that was actually lost or destroyed by all those combined earthquakes we've had probably wouldn't even sufficiently seismatize Salem, let alone Portland and Eugene and Medford and all the rest of places. So could you tell me, or am I putting you too much on the spot?
Yeah. Hey,
is it more important to allow these people to go ahead and rebuild, whether it's seismically done or not?
Good policy, sound policy is really what we're after, and policy that is sensitive to the needs of the businesses as well as the safety of the people who would enter into those buildings with the expectation that they're going to be safe. I understand that importance, but what we have done locally is we've said, okay, if you have seismic goals that you've set for buildings based on the size and the height of the building, then what are your risks for a building that is a one-story brick or concrete construction versus a 3-, 4-, 20-story building, and not have them be the same expectations? And that's the piece that we've been really pushing. We have Bressey Electric, which is a business that through this process we've been able to bring on board that has been, excuse me, considered what you probably would have considered a good old boy kind of business in the back in the olden days, but has now, in working with the local community, has really seen where there's value and sustainability in working with the local residents and the other businesses along the Vancouver-Williams corridor. They want to expand. They'll bring on, I think it's 6 new jobs, but those are jobs at $14 to $18 an hour. And because they hired someone from, quote-unquote, the community, and they see, hey, these people, they can work, and they do good work. And so they've made a commitment to say, we're looking to hire out of this community when we fill these jobs if we can do our expansion. They can't do the expansion right now because it's going to add 30%, I think someone was saying 25% for regulation, 30% to the cost of their building. That prices them out of doing the expansion. It's not prudent for a prudent business decision for them to do it at this point because of that. So we're saying look at ways that for businesses, especially small businesses, to weigh the risk against the opportunity for sure, but also to put it in proportion to the type of building that they're trying to build or that they're trying to add on to, and be a bit more realistic in what they expect in terms of levels of safety for those buildings. And for what, you know, we build for the 100-year flood, and should you be building for a 0.7 for a 10-story building the same way you do for a 1-story building? We think not. But we need the sound science to support us in that, and so that's why we're trying to pull together the advocacy position to address that and find something more realistic. Before that business decide they're going to have to move and just get another building, which will be cheaper than trying to expand where they are,
mm-hmm.
which will be a loss for our community.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
So you build a building that's good to last 35, 40 years, and you design it for the 100-year flood. You can build 3 of them in the meantime. And
yeah.
Sheila, thank you very much for your comments. We have reached 12 o'clock. We will take a 1-hour recess and come back at 1 o'clock.